seems to divide as much as it unifies. What is the role of religion in the climate and ecological crisis? What would drive someone to sew their lips together on video? In this episode of Tipping Points, we'll hear from two retired vicars about their motivations to become die-hard environmental activists. So I have with me two reverends who are deeply involved in environmental activism. Sue Parfitt, who is a retired family therapist from Bristol, and Tim Hughes, a retired dentist from Wantage near Oxford. Both are members of Christian Climate Action, Extinction Rebellion, and Insulate Britain. Tim has experienced prison time, and Sue will be serving a prison sentence later over Christmas this year. I'd very much like to hear your journeys, motivations, relationships with others, and what you hope to see in the future. So starting with Sue, please give us a brief background and if there was a moment when you decided to become an environmental activist.
Well, I think I would have to go back a step and say that I was much involved in the peace movement, and I think a lot of environmental activists were. I mean, it remains the critical thing. We could easily go into a nuclear war anytime, but that's where people cut their teeth, I think, and hone their activists' ideas and skills. I mean, at 18, I was involved in that. And I come from quite a sort of feisty family, really, of activists. I had an ancestor called John Thelwall, who ended up in the Tower of London for sedition. I mean, he wasn't executed, but he was part of the group around at that time, Coleridge and the Romantic poets, who were trying to bring the French Revolution over into England. So, you know, not popular people. And my grandfather, who was an Anglican priest, he became a congregational minister because he fell out with the diocese because they wouldn't let him bury someone who committed suicide. So I come from a background, I think, of feisty people. So it was sort of around, you know. I came into environmental activism through Christian Climate Action through a dear friend of mine who I've known for over 40 years. We've been family therapy colleagues, and we've been university lecturers together. We know each other well. And he said to me one day, he was on his way to London, he said, "Why don't you join Christian Climate Action?" So that's what got me into that. And then I joined IB, and I saw that as a way of getting to the heart of the matter. I mean, I'm afraid planting flower meadows is not going to save the planet. I expect nothing will at this point, but at least I intend to go down fighting.
Thank you. Tim, please give us a bit of background for you as well. And if there was a particular moment you might describe as your tipping point.
Yes, I've been anxious about the climate. I haven't got a history like Sue has of activism. I've been a priest coming up for 20 years. Most of that time I've been concerned about the planet, and that was heightened by Al Gore's DVD that he produced. And I gave a copy of each of that to my four children and said, you know, look at this, you need to look at this. So I've always been an assisting priest. I'm not a vicar, so I'm a priest assisting other vicars. So I was based in Abingdon and assisting the priest there. And at a minister review in 2007, which we all go through, and I was discussing my priestly ministry with Bishop Stephen Cottrell, now Archbishop of York. And I said to him, look, I'm so anxious about the planet. I feel that any sermon that I give has got to have some sort of measure of this in it. I tried to express how difficult I found this, because you can't browbeat elderly and frail, but you've also got to tell the truth. And I was worried about how I was going to get the balance right. And he said, well, Tim, I give you permission to bang on about this and keep banging on about it. And that actually helped me in in the sense that I was getting the church's approval of doing that. And I continued along those lines. But in retrospect, I feel that it was a bit lame. A sort of sense of anxiety was building, and I was almost afraid to address the issue of climate degradation and environmental breakdown, and in fact, the collapse of society, imminent collapse of society. So I was trying to hold this as best I could, and there was a sort of tension building in me, not knowing how to deal with it. Then in the autumn of 2018, I heard Sir David Attenborough say that Extinction Rebellion and the Friday school strike that Greta Thunberg had started was the first glimmer of hope he'd actually seen in what was happening. You know, I've always admired the guy. I mean, I've been watching him on TV for goodness knows, you know, most of my life, certainly 60 years. I remember watching him on TV, you know, when I was 10. He was giving me the green light, you know, and I felt that being the case, if Extinction Rebellion and what Greta Thunberg was saying is giving David Attenborough a glimmer of hope, then I wanted to fan that into a flame. What else could I do? There's no, why wouldn't I do it? You know, here's a man who I respect hugely who is saying this is okay to do. And so as a result of that, I then joined XR. I wanted to sort of commit myself to it. I wasn't quite sure how to do that because I'm quite an introvert, really. I'm not quite sure. But I wanted to have some sort of sign for myself that I was committing to this. I wonder if there's something sort of almost religious in that, like a sort of baptism, if you like. I wanted there to be a mark that, you know, from now on, this is where I'm going. Had my wrist tattooed with the Extinction Rebellion sign as a symbol of, yeah, this is what I'm doing. And from then on, I've been looking for roles as an activist and as best I can.
Yeah, thank you. Having dug a little bit online, Sue, I understand that you and your husband decided not to have children. So when did you make that decision? And could you explain how you arrived to that point?
We decided as soon as we got married, but I would have to say we did marry late, so it would have been a consideration. But I had only just emerged from theological college, and so I was wanting to continue my work, really, or begin my work in the church. I want to preface it with that because I don't want it to be seen as, you know, some more big than it is. But it was a big part of it that we both sat down and said, look, the last thing the planet needs is more children. And I'm firmly committed to that. I think one of the difficulties we have, which we can't talk about, this is a very not to be talked about subject, but one of the big difficulties we have is that we have far too many human beings on the planet which are elbowing out all other species, and they take their habitat and take their resources and all the rest of it. So we felt that the last thing really that the planet needs more human beings.
Yeah, thank you. I understand, Tim, that you have children who are now in their 40s. So are you all on the same page with climate or not? And how do you think their retirements might be different to yours?
Ooh, no, we're not on the same page. And it has caused tensions between us, misunderstandings. We're approaching things in different ways. Yeah, I've got three boys and a girl. They are approaching things from the standpoint of people who are trying to hold a job down, fend for their families. And I respect that. They've not all felt that they could support me in some of the actions that I've been doing, and that's been hard. It is an aspect that's caused anxiety with, you know, between us. But then another aspect of that is that I have to live my life as best I can I still have a responsibility to my children and my grandchildren. If the house is on fire, I've got to shout for the fire brigade. I'm not being true to myself if I don't do that. So, yes, it's very difficult. I have had this conversation with them about, you know, what their retirement will be like, in the sense that, you know, I've said I can't protect you, my children, from what's happening in climate change and the environmental breakdown, any more than you can protect your children from it. And you're going to have to be answerable to them as I am answerable to you, and how you're going to have that conversation with them, my grandchildren, I've no idea, because it's going to be so difficult. As far as their retirement is concerned, I think they may still actually be expecting to enjoy a healthy retirement. I can't look that far ahead. My sights are set short. That's the best way I can live. And in that way, I can actually be focused and hopefully effective.
Yeah, that's a similar thing. This transition for me, I'm 36. And when I was in my 20s, my horizons were miles ahead. I've been thinking, I want to save as much as I can for my mortgage, for my pension, for my blah, 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 blah. And then the more I learned about the immediacy and the challenge that we'll have within the next decade, my horizons became much shorter. And then all of these kind of cascading things about all of the, like, in terms of savings and getting a mortgage and living anywhere and all this kind of stuff kind of fell apart a bit.
Yeah.
And I can see that's a much more difficult thing to draw your horizons closer when you're in your 30s and 40s than perhaps it might be if you're in your 70s or 80s. Would you agree with that?
Well, no. Partly because aspects of life can make you think differently. And one aspect that taught me not to look so far ahead was when my first wife, Melinda, was diagnosed with terminal cancer at the age of 46. So that's when she and I learned that actually we can't be looking far ahead. The horizon's close. We live day to day. Our aim each day is to be able to say to each other, actually, it's been a lovely day. And you know, and that's a blessing. Every day is a blessing. So that's when we learned the hard way that, you know, it's necessary to live like this. And actually, it's a good way to live, because you live life to the full. You know, we do not know what's going to happen to us individually. By day, we could be hit by a bus. And if you haven't said to your loved one as you go out, I love you, and have a hug or a kiss, then you may have missed out on something that you could regret. So it's learning to live in the now, which is, for me, you know, it happened 20 years ago when my wife died. And that's what I learned it when I was 50, 52, not when I hit retirement and felt that, you know, now I'm free to do it. When I hit retirement, I found there was no excuses for me not to do stuff. You know, I'm in a privileged position. Unlike, for example, you, Pete, I don't have a mortgage. And it's not a disaster if I don't have a reference for financial aspects and so on. In some respects, it's all the more important for the elderly to be active, because there's so many much younger people, you know, I can see Sue agrees with that. There's so many young people who are not in this position. We are in something of a privileged position. I accept that. But with that goes responsibility. Yes, it is important for us to live in the now, but it may take a lifetime to learn how to do that. But life can actually bite you in the bum when you least expect it. And then you learn to live in the present.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I wonder if maybe the grief that you experienced with the loss of your first wife, if that's compared to any way in the grief of the loss and degradation of the natural world. So might that grief have helped to prepare for other types of grief?
you asked some tough questions, Pete. Probably not. Each reason for grieving has its own pain. You may actually learn how to deal with it. Yes, I've dealt with grief before. I know how to do it. But actually, a lot of the comfort I take in life is from the natural world. And to see that degraded is actually taking away one of the foundations which I've used for as a restorative from grief in years past. In many respects, it's so much more profound than anything I've previously experienced.
I'd like to move on to more about the activism now. So in March 2021, I understand that you both glued yourselves to the magistrate's court furniture. And Tim, I understand that you had 2 weeks in prison for contempt of court. And Sue, you were released under investigation. Sue, how do you feel about the receiving different sentences?
Well, I know very little about the law, but I have to say my association with it over the last couple of years has made me realise that it's really quite shambolic and that one can't rely on anything happening or with any rhyme or reason. So at the time, we went to the court with our prison bag, entirely expecting to be taken straight to prison, which is what happens with the contempt of court. And we weren't. And then, of course, the next day, Tim and Ben were. So I don't quite know how to answer your question other than to say I just think it's a sort of shambolicness of the law. I can't see any particular reason why. And the funny thing really is that we are, in the end, the investigations have been completed. And so Ruth and I are up before the court on the same day that we're up next week for the IB actions. And so clearly we can't be in two places at once. But the it's now been reduced from contempt of court to the charge of taking a picture of a judge in court and posting it on the Facebook. So we're both pleading guilty to that because we think it's such a trivial idea and we can't go anyway. So I should think they'll drop it, really. But, you know, it's an example, isn't it, of how things move and change, and you just have to try and go with it, really.
And speaking about the way that things change, could you describe how it felt to be arrested for the first time? And did that make the following times a little bit easier?
I think each time is in its own right. I mean, I think, you know, in IB, I've been arrested 12 times now since September the 15th, I think we started, didn't we? So it becomes, you know, rather routine.
Interesting. Tim, your experience was different. Was that the first time that you experienced prison?
I was arrested for the first time in September 2019. So that would be just a year after I'd heard the David Attenborough thing. Having joined Extinction Rebellion, done the training, gone to London, day one of the XR action in London. And there were thousands of people in London, streets blocked, and an amazingly diverse group of people, all ages, children, elderly. It was an amazing experience. There were professional people there. I was with a carpenter from the area. There were electricians. I went to a soup kitchen, which was run in Trafalgar Square by a coroner and a psychiatrist. They were married. And they were saying, we cannot take part in the protests, but we are here to support the people who are doing so, have some soup and bread and stuff. And then I went down to Parliament Street, down towards the corner of Downing Street. And I heard at that moment that Boris Johnson had declared that people not to worry about the Extinction Rebellion activity because it was only a few old crusties smelling of hemp. And I was so incensed by that he dismissed the activism of scientists and young mothers and expectant mothers, the elderly, the professionals, such a wide range of people. I was so angry. So that's when I thought, okay, right, well, I'm going to lie down in outside Downing Street, and was arrested and spent 12 or 15 hours in custody afterwards. I then went to court as a result of that some months later. I was given a conditional discharge. The following week, I went back to the court and decided that I would glue on, because the court should never have found me guilty. The people who are guilty, it was the people who are perpetuating the use of fossil fuels and the degradation of the environment, which, however the government want to spin it, they are still responsible for such a lot of the what's happening in our country that is contrary to the Paris Accord. Not insulating social housing, for example. It's a no-brainer to think that the best way to stop emissions is by making sure that the fuel that we use is used efficiently. So insulate social housing. Solar panels on roofs, you know, why isn't that being done? There's so many simple things you think, just look at that, look at the rhetoric, look at what's happening. There's a huge gap, and it's because the government are actually talking green but doing very little. Concentrating on electric cars, well, we shouldn't actually be using cars. So it'll be fine for people who can afford a £50,000 Tesla who can charge their cars. And yeah, great. I'm sure a lot of his buddies will be doing that. But for lesser mortals, then we're not in a position to do that. I wanted to draw the attention to that. And I felt that by gluing myself in court would highlight the sense of the government is not doing enough. And so I did glue on, and Ben Bewes and I were sentenced to 2 weeks in prison. I then went on what I called an earth fast, and I decided I wasn't going to eat while I was in prison. I was on a water-only diet, and we were released after 6 days. Why that was the case, I have no idea. In fact, for contempt, I have since discovered that it's not eligible to be released on license, so you have to serve the full term, but we didn't. So I came out of Wandsworth, we came out of Wandsworth 6 days later.
I wonder, when you were in Wandsworth prison, did you learn anything about yourself or society while you were there? Did you speak with many other inmates, and did you find common ground?
Yes, I did. I was sharing with Ben, so that actually made things a lot easier for us. But I had huge respect for the prison officers. And also, the environment within prison is very, very tough. I knew that. I knew it was going to be, because when I was doing my ordination training in 20 years ago, I did a placement in Bullingdon Prison in Oxfordshire. And I knew then that was the case. So I knew what I was going for. But yeah, it's a very tough environment. But I did learn quite a bit about myself and what I'm capable of, and actually how to keep my head down and keep out of people's way. I respected them because they were actually in there for a long time. We'd chosen to be there. They hadn't. A lot of the people there, I thought, hey, guys, you're in the right place. But actually, it was nonetheless quite a scary place to be.
Sue, you're heading off to prison in a week or so, is that right?
Barring the unpredictability of the courts, yes, that's what right. Should be happening, yes.
Yeah, and how do you feel about that? And hearing Tim's experience, do you think your experience will be different, especially with it being over Christmas?
I simply don't know at all. I mean, I find it a scary prospect, there's no doubt about that. It's not going to be a walk in the park. And it's worse in a way than I anticipated, because I have to say, anticipating that I might well be, you know, locked up with my books, and that wouldn't be too bad at all, really. But I hear that they're not allowing anybody to take anything in. Already I'm making the effort to get people to write in and make contact with the chaplain, because not to be allowed one's Bible or one's office book, I mean, I would just find that beyond what I could cope with, I think. Now, I understand that a drug problem is fearful in prisons, so that they've got to, this is the reason probably why they're not going to allow you books, because people can just steep them in drugs and then roll up the pages and smoke them, etc. And they do allow you to be sent books, I gather, from bookshops. But Yes, I mean, it's not going to be easy. It'll be much easier, of course, if I'm in a cell with one of my the three women in this group. So three of us will go to probably the same prison, I imagine, and probably be Bronzefield because there aren't many women's prisons. But I do also view it as a necessary part of the action. I mean, if you think of all the other big social actions in the past, the suffragettes and the independence for India and the civil rights, etc. I mean, it does require people to make this sacrifice. Now, I don't see it much like that for myself, but I do understand that this is part of what we need to do as activists who would want to be in prison over Christmas, especially. I think perhaps particularly in a women's prison, the sort of women who are there will be parted from their young children at Christmas. People will be so grieved and so distraught, I think, to be there at Christmas. So I hope there'll be opportunity to get alongside people as well, and to be, you know, looking out for them, as well as hopefully keeping my head down, as Tim says. No good having any illusions about it, I'm sure.
This is Pete from the future. A week after this interview, Sue Parfitt predicted the unpredictability of the courts and was handed a 2-month suspended sentence to her surprise. And the leniency of the sentence was in contrast to the immediate jail terms handed to protesters by judges just a month before.
When I was in Wandsworth, there were a lot of people who were in for overstaying visa and were going to be deported. There was quite a few people who were struggling with that. But actually, there was also a sense that, oh yeah, one of the things that when we went in, the officer who was booking us in was saying, actually, we have a lot of people with mental health issues in the prison. And actually, prison is no place. They shouldn't be here. It's because there are no other places for them to go, which is a poor statement about our society. And he said, and the very last thing we need is climate activists coming in. And I understand that. But actually, it's only the sense of sacrifice that Sue talked about, with people prepared to put themselves on the line sufficiently to be able to go to prison, that highlights the absurdity of the society we live in, where scientists and people of vision who can actually see what's happening and who are not self-seeking politicians prepared to overlook the signs of catastrophe for their own benefit. It's only people of integrity in these absurd positions, including being in prison, that we're left with to highlight the issues we're trying to draw attention to. I never anticipated, you know, reaching 70 and finishing up in being in prison. It's just absolutely absurd. But unfortunately, the way society is organized, there's nothing left to us. But yes, I did, you know, by being in prison, it was a lot of people that I met. And actually, it was very, very broadening for me and very humbling.
To come in a second, but I'd like to say at this point that I'll be recording interviews on the topics the police, the media, education and air travel from the start of February. So if you have any questions about the role of these topics in addressing the climate and ecological crisis, or to give feedback on the podcast, please email tippingpoints, all one word, at imperial.ac.uk. You can find the privacy policy at the Imperial College Grantham Institute website. Now on with the podcast. I wonder, moving on now to more about Christianity, I have a question that's been on my mind for a while, because I know that colonialism has had a dramatic effect on the injustice and inequality that's rife in the world, as well as white superiority and the control of the economy. And there are some strong links between, in a historical sense, between religion and colonialism. So I wonder how that might sit with you.
Yes. Well, I mean, we are only, I suppose, more recently understanding this, I think, aren't we? And I mean, I was brought up in a very much of a sort of colonialist family, I suppose, and a deeply Christian family, and they were all either copper miners or tea planters or missionaries, and the two were all intertwined, you know, as you rightly say. And it was almost as though, you know, the missionaries went to kind of cement the empire and to forward the empire. What can we do about it now? Well, we can do quite a lot about it. I'm very much in favor of all the efforts, like with Black Lives Matter and so forth. And I'm extremely proud to be a Bristolian who knocked old Colson off his perch and dumped him in the sea. There's lots we can do, and we need to make reparation. And I was in Australia once when I saw a film at their old Parliament building of Gough Whitman apologising to the Aborigines for what white Australians had done. And I can't tell you about it because I shall cry. But it was so deeply moving. He went through about 10 points. All the Aboriginal community was invited, and he said, for interrupting your ancestral religions and dreamlands, we apologize. For taking away your land, we apologize. For putting your children into care, we apologize. He went through about 10 things. And I mean, everybody was all in tears and everything. And I think it was a deeply healing thing to do. And so you hear about people saying, well, we can't apologize for the past. It wasn't our fault. We weren't alive. But it's nonsense. We are people who benefit enormously from the past. And of course, that also is true of our responsibility for climate change and the way in which we, Tim and my generation, have benefited enormously in our lives from the exploitation of fossil fuels. And so it actually behoves us as oldies, and I'd like to get back to the point that Tim made earlier, that as oldies, we have both a particular responsibility and a huge freedom to do what we're doing. When I get out of prison, I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to recruit from the elderly and say, well, you know, it's not, the question isn't why am I doing this? The question is, why are you not doing it? So I don't know if that answers your question.
Until recently, I felt that the damage done by the British colonists was something very much in the past, and I didn't feel it very relevant to me at the time. In recent times, my attitude to that has changed, and the reason for this is because the Church of England has still got big investments in oil companies.
17 million, isn't it, I think?
Yep, and still not calling out government for its shortcomings on acting on against climate change and the environment. And I've been having an exchange, Bishop of Oxford, and I couldn't understand, because he wrote to me saying that he wanted me to desist from my actions with Insulate Britain, because he thought it was having a negative effect on the campaign for climate change, had a negative effect leading up to COP26, and was distracting people from the real issues. And I found that very disturbing. He did not mention the fact that over 9,000 people will die this winter from the effects of cold houses. I found that very difficult. It made me realize that actually the church is currently, in my view, too tightly bound to the government and to the establishment. But it gave me a perspective on historical colonialism that I can now recognize in the way the church is acting today. I would actually draw a parallel with this in the sense that I am trying to draw attention to the church that it should be divesting of fossil fuels. And my feeling is that this may well be a similar frustration that people had within the church while slavery was still active, and when the ravages of colonialism were so excessive. It took enormous effort for people to move the church and the state in the right direction as far as that was concerned. And I now see that it is enormously difficult to move the church from divesting of fossil fuels. I recognize that dioceses have independently separately done it, but there are elements within the church, the pension board and the church commissioners, they are invested in fossil fuels. And the sense that the church and government being aligned and moving together, propping each other up, is actually now, I find, very disturbing. And I'm not sure, you know, where I sit with that. I've suggested to my area bishop that he come to an action with us against the church commissioners. I mean, it's his pension that's going to be affected, not mine. I'm non-stipendiary, so I don't get a pension that's benefited from the investment in fossil fuels. My area bishop does.
How do you feel about the actions of the current Pope?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I admire this Pope because he is trying to revolutionise an institution that doesn't actually go in for much modernisation. And I wouldn't have thought until recently that our church, the Church of England and the Catholic Church, had that sort of sense of commonality. We have a certain common sense of our understanding of Jesus Christ. Of course we do. But I admire this Pope, and I admire the fact that he is a humble man and a man of modesty and wants that, to promote that. But quite how he is going to lead the machinery of the Catholic Church along those lines, I don't know. But I suspect that he's having equal trouble with it as we are in the Church of England. I think we're both struggling with the same issues, and that is that the direction of the Church of England, the direction of the Catholic Church is like a supertanker.
So do you have any thoughts about the Pope?
Well, yes, I see him as the one big bright star in Christendom on this issue. I mean, he is tirelessly talking about it. I mean, his encyclical Laudato Si must be the most influential encyclical that's ever happened, really. You know, one of the things about the Roman Catholic Church that the Pope does have enormous freedom to do these sorts of things. He doesn't have total freedom, and he's actually very unpopular in parts of his own communion. But I think the Church of England has particular problems. I've never understood this as clearly as I have recently, being the established church. And it's what Tim has been talking about. You know, we are a part of the government, really. We are linked in with the state. We are the state church, and we're wheeled out for all these occasions, awful things like blessing of Trident and celebrating 50 years of continuous deterrence at sea. They never use the word Trident, actually. A big service at Westminster Abbey to glorify Trident. We're so seduced as human beings, aren't we? I think it must be very seductive for our bishops, who are the only people, not other denominations, but Church of England bishops, not all of them, but certain dioceses, are in the House of Lords, and they dress up in these, you know, robes, and they look the part. But I can see, looking at the video of her giving a speech in the House of Lords, how very seductive this position is for anyone, and how very difficult, therefore, how difficult for any of our bishops to take the government on. I mean, they're not going to start saying, look, you've declared a climate emergency, but you're doing absolutely nothing about it. They're not going to say things like that to the government. They do amend. I mean, they are influential, I think, in amending some legislation from time to time. But it's a huge issue, more for us as Anglicans in the Church of England than it is for other denominations.
Sorry to butt in. Well, I wish our bishop had joined us in Slate Britain. Would it have been possible as a result of that for the government to have ignored it? And would it have been possible as a result of that, that the government would have then decided to insulate social housing and, rather than maintaining that iniquity of not doing it, even though they promised it 10 years previously? I mean, I don't think the government could have ignored that. In which case, you know, our bishops, they've been actually propping up the government and the government's attitude by not joining us. They should have actually been on the street with us and given us the legitimacy of their presence, but they chickened out. And by doing that, they've actually thrown us to the dogs.
Yes, I think we've got to call that out too, Tim. And I think in the new iteration of Insulate Britain, which will be another name and focus on another thing, it would be very good to have some placards saying, "Where are the bishops?" We've got to tackle this one.
From a personal point of view, the Archbishop of York, when he was Bishop of Reading, told me to bang on about this. So why isn't he supporting us now?
Yes.
What do you think the reason might be?
Well, I suspect that Sue's got it, you know, because being in the House of Lords, you're trying to influence from the inside. But my feeling and my guess is that Sue's feeling is it ain't going to happen because it's impossible for them to be able to get their hands on the steering wheel.
Okay, yeah. Do you see environmental activism bringing different religions together?
Well, it's funny you should mention that because one of our friends, Diana, she, as a Buddhist, was in the back of a police van with a Catholic priest and two Anglican priests. And yet we were acting together as one, totally focused on what we knew was essential to do for the best that we could be doing at that time for our planet. I've experienced this in other ways and other times when we have a focus to act for the good of humanity. It does bring people together. I mean, that happened with people fighting against apartheid, people fighting fascism.
Tim, I just wanted to ask for a couple of minutes about your experience when you sewed your lips together outside News Corp, because I think that was quite a powerful thing for people to witness, people to see the video of you doing that. And it makes, when I mentioned it to my mum, she shuddered. And that's the kind of really powerful imagery which can make people think again. Now, I want to know, what was your main message? And did you think that that story was reported fairly?
I wanted to draw attention to the fact that the power lies with media moguls, corporate billionaires, and not so much with the electorate. We can be fooled into thinking that we have power, but in fact, the power lies with people like Rupert Murdoch. So they have a stick and a carrot relationship with the government. And the carrot is, we will help get you elected. The stick is, you know, and if you don't do what we say, then we're going to slam you in the press. There's a very good example of it yesterday when Boris Johnson was being having to face all sorts of questions about the party in Downing Street that was not a party. It was very interesting that that was actually not in the newspaper The Sun at all. And this is Rupert Murdoch's, you know, letting Boris Johnson off the hook because he knew that it would actually damage Boris Johnson. For months, I'd been thinking about how I could express my sense of absolute frustration. And this is the only thing that I could think of. I mean, he muted climate science for decades and he's actually helped get climate science deniers elected. And that includes Boris, who was denying the science 5 years ago, and Trump and Scott Morrison and others. And so I felt that the only way that I could actually demonstrate how he had muted climate science was by symbolically sewing my lips up as a sense of frustration. It was done. It's been done before. It was done in the Calais jungle by people trying to come to Britain who felt they were voiceless. And my voice could not be heard about the climate science being muted. Nobody's interested in that. And the press won't print it. And it was also done about 10 years ago by almost 1,000 Russian prisoners. And they were objecting to their own prison conditions. They had nothing else they could do. And that's how I felt, was that Rupert Murdoch had actually done this. He'd silenced climate scientists. He'd silenced people who wanted to speak out about climate change for decades. So I wanted to demonstrate that. I wanted there to be a sense that he had actually sewn my lips up. Well, of course, I guessed that his press wouldn't cover it, and they didn't. I was a dentist, so I was an oral surgery registrar in Sheffield decades ago. So I've done a lot of sewing of faces and mouths and lips and noses and ears and scalps. It was a bit scary because I was wondered if I'd be able to do it and not sort of pass out or...
Did you use anaesthetic then or not?
No, I just felt that, you know, using it to numb up the lips, you know, it would just be too difficult to do it for myself. And so I just cracked on. And actually I was acting as almost if I was working on a patient. So I was able to distance myself from it. And actually my friend who was holding the mirror, Ruth, she was humming Amazing Grace, which is rather nice, actually.
Excellent. A fascinating talk. Thank you very much, Sue Parfitt and Tim Hughes, for that engaging and inspiring conversation.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you're doing.
But fascinating questions, Peter, and I think you're coming from such an interesting and important place. I hope you'll be around asking these questions to lots of people. Thank you.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project, who communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.